This podcast is supported by USA for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. UNHCR responds to humanitarian emergencies around the world that have caused record levels of displacement and human suffering. 90% of refugees live in countries facing food shortages and malnutrition. Your support is crucial in delivering vital aid to the world's most vulnerable families. Will you help support refugees by making a gift today? Together, we can help refugees and displaced people all around the world. Donate today at unrefugees.org/donation.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, its de facto capital is falling. Its territory has shriveled from the size of a small country to just a handful of outposts. Its surviving leaders are on the run, and its members are surrendering. Is ISIS losing its war or starting a new one? It's Thursday, October 19th. Rod, tell me about the military base you visited recently in Iraq.
Well, it's in a town called Dibbis, which is in northern Iraq.
Rod Nordland is the Kabul bureau chief for The Times.
And it was actually an intelligence base. It was kind of the Kurdish government's equivalent of the CIA.
Just to be clear, the Kurdish government is one of the factions that governs Iraq. And the Kurds are an ethnic minority there, right?
Right. They have a base there that they use for processing, usually refugees.
And what's been bringing these refugees to this base?
In this case, there was a battle in the town of Hawija.
Fighting still rages in a pocket to the north and east of the town where the militants are reportedly surrounded.
The Americans were bombing the place massively, which they hadn't done before. And the Iraqi army had finally attacked it. And they were advancing very quickly, much more quickly than anybody expected them to. In fact, there was very little resistance, it appeared.
Iraqi forces celebrate coming a step closer to eradicating Islamic State.
And people just began fleeing, and they fled toward Kurdish lines and ended up in this processing center. They were brought in by trucks. They're literally kind of dump trucks, and they lower the tailgate, and it's just packed full of women and children, which is what you'd expect. I didn't expect to see any men at all, but we thought we could at least interview some of the women and children and maybe old men who were fleeing and get a sense of what was happening inside the city.
And why didn't you expect to see men?
Because most of the men in Hawija would either be ISIS militants or they would be held by ISIS. ISIS wouldn't let fighting age men leave.
So do you actually see men along with the women and the children?
Yeah, a huge number of men. About a third of them were young men of fighting age. Anything from teenager up to the 50s, say. Any able-bodied man, basically.
Who do you think that these men are?
First of all, they're all very dirty, very bedraggled. None of them are armed. They don't have any weapons. The ones who were fighters left those behind. And they just seemed like kind of sorry, sad sack cases for the most part. Hmm. The Kurds immediately separated the men and put them in positions from which they could control them easily. And that meant, in their case, on their knees with their heads bowed to the ground. So it looked like they're almost praying, in fact. But that's a very awkward position, and it's a hard position to attack somebody from. And, you know, the Kurds were a little concerned. The Kurds had weapons, but there were a whole lot more of these men than there were Kurdish guards. So they put them in these positions, and they began tying their hands behind their backs. And then they began just going through the crowd and saying, who is ISIS?
So that guy said he was saying, what's he
done?
So he
said, any for 1 minute, for 1 hour, for 1 day, who joined ISIS, let them come out.
They're asking, who is ISIS?
Yeah, and they're doing it in a kind of crafty way. They're saying, you know, we know who's ISIS, so we're going to give you a chance now to own up to it, and we'll treat you better if you do. If you don't tell us, things are not going to go so well for you. This is an intelligence base, and they had been for months and years even, since 2014, saving video, propaganda video put out by ISIS. And there was a lot of it from Hawija. Because Hawija had at one point had a fairly significant Kurdish minority. there were a lot of Kurdish prisoners there, and they were publicly executed, and often in very horrible ways.
ISIS and another video, this time showing captured Kurdish fighters. We see Peshmerga soldiers in cages, this time paraded through a crowded city street.
Put in small cages and set afire, beheaded publicly. And when you look at the videos, there are tens of thousands of people on the streets cheering wildly and even stoning the prisoners. Basically, anybody who was at a beheading, as far as the Kurds were concerned, was a culprit.
And how old is he?
I'm
31.
Okay. So you sat in on some of these interrogations.
On some of them, yeah. And they actually let me interview them, although all of my interviews were monitored.
By?
By one of the Kurdish intelligence guys.
What were those interrogations like?
They were mainly aimed at finding out who was who. And a really common syndrome was they would say, yes, I was an ISIS fighter, but only for 27 days, you know, and then I quit.
And was he an ISIS fighter?
Yes, only he stayed with them only for 2 months.
Only for 2 months. For only 2 months. And why did he leave them?
ليش بطلت؟
بطلت الشغل مساعد. لأن الناس تورطنا إحنا وجوعانين الناس.
أنا عندي والد because I knew that was not the right thing to do and we were just hungry and poor people. That was the basic reason that we pledged to them.
And it was such a common claim that it seemed like they had been coach to say that.
That I was a short-term fighter, that I didn't last long, that I didn't like it?
Right, and that I was opposed to what they did, and I saw what they were, and I was against it. Occasionally, you'd catch somebody, like, glancing at someone, you know, in a—
A fellow ISIS fighter?
No, looking at the guards in an unguarded moment, you know, and you'd kind of catch a little bit of fire in their eyes.
Tell me about Maitham Mohammed, one of the guys that was interrogated.
Yeah, this guy was really scary. They brought him into the room, and even though his hands were tied behind his back, he kind of filled the doorway. He was a big guy. He had this horrendous smell, but even more so was his just physical presence. And everybody in the room was scared of him.
Just because of his size and smell.
And the way he looked at everybody. He just looked angry and dangerous. Immediately, one of the Kurdish officers went around the room making sure there were no weapons laying around. Because it was an interrogation room with several desks of Kurdish officers. So even the armed officers escorting this guy in were kind of nervous. And they sat him down next to me, and I was very nervous too. And I was thinking, you know, I mean, we're all raised on these movies in which people in captivity do incredible things to everyone in the room, you know. And this guy looked like someone who maybe actually could do that. And he was more defiant than most of the others that I interviewed. He didn't try to say he'd only been in ISIS for a few weeks. He was really admitting it. He wasn't admitting all of it, though. According to the Kurdish officers, they already knew who he was. They had his name. Mm-hmm. And they had him as a member of this suicide group of elite ISIS fighters known as Seekers of Martyrdom. So they thought he was just a really bad actor. He was about 21 or so. And they put him down in a chair with his hands tied behind his back, and he was pretty uncomfortable. Then they, you know, told me I could go ahead and talk to him. And we spent quite a lot of time talking. And as we did, taking him through the stages of what they've been through in Hawija, and then got to the part where his own commander of Islamic State in that community had told him and the other men just to flee and make whatever deal they could with the Kurds. They were told by their leaders to surrender themselves and their families.
And why did he say that the general told them to flee and to surrender?
Well, he said because it looks like we're finished and we're done for now.
Rod, you said he was a member of an elite suicide group within ISIS. What does that mean, first of all? And second of all, why would somebody who's a member of a group that would seem to exist to end his life in the service of ISIS, why would he ever surrender alive?
Kind of humiliating, yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, he denied he was in that particular group.
Okay.
The Kurds, too, were very nervous about guys like this because they figured, you know, maybe they'll seek their martyrdom there while they're in captivity. And I don't think in his case that was the scenario. You know, his wife was there along with, well, his pregnant wife who would soon be having their first child.
This is the ISIS fighter.
The ISIS fighter, yeah. And he was pretty crestfallen when he found out that he probably would not be allowed to visit her. She was processed in the same place but taken to a refugee camp. And
what was his appearance and his reaction when he learned he would not be able to?
Just kind of hanging his head. Just gradually, the more we talked, the more defeated and sorry he seemed about the whole thing. And it just occurred to me several times, well, it's just a man, you know, it's just a man. And a man that took maybe a really horrible path and did really horrible things or was prepared to do horrible things. But at the end of the day, he's just a man like any of us.
So you've been covering this conflict between ISIS and states like Iraq and the region for years. What impression did this experience leave on you, watching all of these Islamic State fighters surrendering one by one to these officials in this processing center?
Yeah, it was just astonishing. I never expected to see this. I was in Iraq in 2014 after this group of a few hundred, maybe 700 Islamic State fighters took the city of Mosul, mm-hmm. you know, defeating two full divisions of the Iraqi army.
Islamic militants seized control of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city with 1.5 million people.
And then rolling all the way south almost to the gates of Baghdad. And you know, at that time, they seemed completely unstoppable. Mm-hmm.
The group had already taken the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi in the west.
And what they had going for them was their ability to instill terror. You know, the fact that they weren't going to surrender. They were going to fight to the death in every occasion. And that's a very difficult opponent to defeat. These guys that I saw, although some of them were kind of scary looking fellows, you know, once you saw them in this situation, it was just hard to imagine them as this fearsome force that they had once had been. And I think they no longer are. And it was really an astonishing thing to see.
Do they talk about themselves as if they have given up the larger battle?
A lot of them did. I mean, to some extent, I think they may have felt that that's what their captors wanted to hear. But a lot of them were really resentful and rueful about it and saying things like, you know, our leaders have sold us down the river and we're finished. The Islamic State is finished and you know, it's never going to be the force that it once was.
Rod, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
We'll be right back.
With Schwab Investing Themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Rukmini, what just happened in the Syrian city of Raqqa?
So after months and months of fighting, U.S.-backed forces are announcing that they have taken the city of Raqqa, the de facto capital of the Islamic State.
And what does that mean for ISIS?
So Raqqa had this outsized influence in the Islamic State, even though it was much smaller than Mosul, which was the largest town that they held anywhere and was in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Mosul, just as an example, had around 2 million people before ISIS came, whereas Raqqa, before ISIS came, had around 200,000 people.
200,000, so, not, which is not a huge number.
Raqqa was roughly a tenth of the size of Mosul, much smaller, but it became their capital. They called it the capital of the Islamic State. It was the place where the American and European hostages were taken. James Foley, Peter Kasich, Kayla Mueller, that was where they were moved to.
And presumably, is it where they were murdered?
Most likely, it's where James Foley was killed. The others were killed elsewhere. But it was the center of so much of what we know of as the Islamic State. And as a result, the loss of it is obviously a symbolic blow.
So, Rukmini, this is starting to feel like a turning point for ISIS, because Mosul was wrested from ISIS control. You were actually there. You reported on it for The Daily and for The Times. Now Raqqa has just fallen in Syria. And we just heard from our colleague, Rod Nordland, that ISIS fighters in the city of Hawija are surrendering to Kurdish forces and saying, as they're surrendering, that the Islamic State is basically finished. It's over.
Right.
Are they right?
Right.
Is the Islamic State, with all these territorial losses, in a sense, finished?
In fact, Michael, they've lost even more land than you have mentioned. In addition to Raqqa and Mosul and Hawija, they've also lost the town of Hasaka in Syria, the town of Membij in Syria, parts of Deir ez-Zor province, Sinjar, Tal Afar. These are major areas of Iraq and Syria. In all, I think that they have lost around 90% of the territory they held. But let me explain to you what that means in real terms. They've lost 90% of the territory they had, but they still have 10%. And that 10% is roughly, from what we're hearing, around 3,800 square miles. That's a little bit smaller than the size of Connecticut.
Okay.
That's not a small area. In terms of numbers of fighters, I just got an email a few days ago from the U.S.-backed coalition that is fighting them. And the estimated troop strength of ISIS just in Iraq and Syria right now is between 6 to 10,000 fighters in those two countries. Put that in perspective. When America left Iraq in 2011, we left behind, our best intelligence assessment was, 700 fighters. So we're talking 8 to 14 times bigger than the group that we left behind, the embers that we left behind, that roared back into this enormous, really global fire, which was ISIS.
So what does ISIS look like when its territory shrinks in a place like Raqqa or Mosul? What happens exactly?
So one metaphor that I've heard used to describe ISIS is like a cancer in your body. So imagine that you're able to remove a tumor from one part of your body, but you don't get there before the cancer has metastasized. And it's now in your bloodstream. It's now moved to other parts of your organism. And that is certainly what ISIS has done. Iraq and Syria is what we think of as the base of the caliphate. But in fact, they're in Libya. They're in Yemen. They're in Afghanistan. They're in West Africa. A video has just come out showing ISIS sympathizers in Congo, right? So they're already in all of these other places. In addition, you still have 6 to 10,000 fighters. These are the 6 to 10,000 fighters who have survived this aerial bombardment that has been happening now every single day since 2014. You can imagine that these are some of the most hardened fighters.
And where do we suspect that surviving fighters go?
Well, we saw just now in Raqqa that there was basically a deal between the tribal elders in the area and ISIS, which allowed some of them to be bussed out in return for essentially leaving the city and and stopping the destruction of the city, because otherwise it would have been leveled. And we've seen these deals in different places. So fighters are getting away, and the governments on hand don't have the capacity to arrest every single one of them. They're already overwhelmed just dealing with the emirs, the commanders, the killers, the rapists.
The worst of ISIS.
The worst of ISIS, right. I mean, I was able to go to areas all over Iraq and interview people that had been administrators for ISIS, civilians that had worked with them.
Lower level.
Right, lower level people. And obviously, they must have had an affinity for the terrorist group if they continued carrying out functions for them.
And so those people may never be arrested. They may never be picked up. They may just keep the flame of ISIS alive wherever they go.
Right, right. So this is a group that began without land. It's now heading in the direction of, again, being landless. But they don't necessarily need land to do what they do, which is to seed this murderous ideology around the world, to inspire attacks, to carry out acts of violence, and to plan for the next time when they can claim a territory here and there.
We've been so conditioned to think that the Islamic State controlling large amounts of land
Is dangerous.
Is dangerous. Is the most devastating version of them.
Yes, I agree. I don't want to underplay what's happened here. For sure, for sure, losing these places is an important step in the fight against ISIS. But that's not all that ISIS is. And keep in mind, ISIS knew this was coming. And you can see it in their propaganda, the way they've moved the goalpost. So whereas before it was all about establishing a territorial caliphate, the soil of this land that they were going to till with their version of Islam, now they're talking about the caliphate that is in their hearts. They're also starting to talk in the past tense about this golden era that they had, romanticizing it. And since they already have an audience of people that believes everything they say and, doesn't believe anything I write, they actually believe, you know, that the streets of Mosul were a place where the women were virtuous and covered, where pornography didn't exist, where thieves didn't dare to take anything because they would have had their hands cut off, and where the word of God was respected.
Rukmini, what is more dangerous? An ISIS that controls a lot of land, has a capital, has a territory of its own, or this current phase of ISIS that has lost so much land and is more diffuse?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm divided on that. On the one hand, obviously the territory is extremely important because that's how they make money.
Mm-hmm.
They taxed the people under their control. And you need money to sustain this army of terrorists.
And there's oil. And there's oil
and there's agriculture and there's every human activity that is there. But on the other hand, by losing territory, they no longer have a fixed address, right? So at least before, we sort of kind of knew where they were. And now, as each of these towns is taken, you've kind of kicked the hornet's nest. There's going to be the fighters that are killed during that battle. There's going to be others that turn themselves in, like the people that my colleague Rod spoke to and that I've also interviewed. But then there's the ones that get away, the ones that go to ground and that live to fight another day.
Rukmini, thank you.
My pleasure, Michael. It's always great to be on.
Here's what else you need to know today. The mother of a U.S. soldier killed in the recent ambush in Niger is confirming accounts that President Trump told the soldier's wife in a phone call on Tuesday that her husband, quote, knew what he signed up for.
I had a very nice conversation with the woman, with the wife, who is sounded like a lovely woman.
President Trump denies saying those words to the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, and he's challenging the account of Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Florida, who says she was in the car with the soldier's wife when she took the call.
Didn't say what that congresswoman said. Didn't say it at all. She knows it, and she now is not saying it. I did not say what she said.
But Congresswoman Wilson says the call, which she says she heard over speakerphone, was actually worse than reported.
And when she actually hung up the phone, she looked at me and said, he didn't even know his name. Now that's the worst part.
The incident began on Monday when a reporter asked President Trump why he had not spoken publicly about the ambush in Niger 2 weeks ago that killed four Green Berets, including Sergeant Johnson. The president said he had written letters to the soldiers' families.
They've been sent or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend. I will, at some point during the period of time, call the parents and the families, because I have done that traditionally.
Then falsely asserted that past presidents did not contact the families of American troops killed in duty.
You look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
Generative AI is not a one-size-fits-all. If you're powering a customer chat experience, you need instant speed at low cost. If you're doing complex R&D or advanced analysis, you need frontier intelligence. The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic offers a model for every task and budget. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and most cost-effective model on the market. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to power their AI solutions. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.